This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Sometimes it's the normal, sometimes it's the abnormal, sometimes it's the paranormal. No matter what it is, it's all beyond reality. Welcome to the program, everyone. Glad you're along with us tonight. We have a great show in store for you. We talk about UFOs on this program frequently. And we talk about the incident at Roswell now and again. And tonight we're going to tie some things together because our guests, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, have written a book called UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. And they refer to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as the real Area 51. So we'll talk about what happened in Roswell. And then we're going to talk about what's happening in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Eyewitness accounts from the real Area 51. That's tonight's conversation. Looking forward to this. We will, of course, take your phone calls later in the program. Write down the phone number. There's two to choose from. If you don't need toll-free, it's 607-282-4497. If you need a toll-free number, most of us don't these days, but if you do, it's 844-687-7669. When you get a chance, go to the Facebook page, Beyond Reality Radio, and give it a like. And also swing by my Facebook page. You can find it by just typing in JVJ Paranormal. Give that page a like, too. And then finally, I'll send you to the YouTube channel, because the YouTube channel offers a very unique opportunity for people to see the program, listen to the program. If you don't have a radio station in your area yet carrying the show, you can go to YouTube and stream it live. It's youtube.com/C/JV Johnson, or you just search JV Johnson, you'll find it as well. The channel also has about 300 back episodes there, so a great archive of programs if you want to catch up on some old interviews and discussions that we've had on Beyond Reality Radio. Great place to go. Again, just go to YouTube, search for JV Johnson. There's also a nice chat room there. A lot of people join the chat on the YouTube channel, comment about our topics, share stories, share information, share ideas. It's a great group of people, and it's a great place to be to help enhance your enjoyment of the program. A lot of great stuff coming up on the show, of course, and we'll get to the schedule a little bit later. I do want to mention, though, we've got some pretty interesting stuff coming up next week that I want to highlight. On Tuesday night, John Zeta, who is a journalist, will be with us to discuss his new book called In the Valleys of the Noble Beyond, which is a search for Sasquatch book, particularly while he was researching the Great Bear Rainforest. And then on Wednesday night, Rick Shapiro, who is a cancer consultant, a researcher, and an educator, will be talking about his book called Hope Never Dies. And he relates stories of people who beat the odds and survived cancer. Those are very, very hopeful stories. And hopefully they will not only inspire you, but they'll be an inspiration to somebody who might be battling cancer. I know that in my family alone, I've been through it many times with different family members. It's a disease that not just affects the person who's suffering from it, but everybody around them and everybody who loves them as well. So, once again, that's Wednesday night's program next week with Rick Shapiro. His book is called Hope Never Dies. So a lot of great things coming up on the show, of course, and we're looking forward to doing all of that. And let's see, I don't really have anything else to say here to get started, so let's take a break, come back. We'll bring in our two guests together, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. We're going to be talking about the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, how it relates to Roswell, and how it relates to the government's cover-up of alien technologies and UFOs, particularly maybe remnants of a crash at the Roswell site. It's Beyond Reality Radio. We'll be right back.
Did you know that online retailers like Amazon have constant deals that can save you money on the things you buy every day? It's no joke. Save 40%, 50%, even 80% on great products. And all you have to do is know about them. Noodle Shark is the way to be alerted when something good is coming your way. Noodle Shark is the social media page that lists great deals that not only save you money, but give you the deals before anyone else has them. All you have to do is find Noodle Shark on Facebook. Search it as The Noodle Shark. That's The Noodle Shark, because you deserve to save too. Become a
shark and save.
Joining me, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, authors of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. Gentlemen, welcome to Beyond Reality Radio. It's great to have you both here.
Nice to be with you.
Good to be back. Thank you.
All right, so I want to start this out because there's somebody that we really owe a great deal of debt and gratitude to, who we lost just a couple of months ago. And of course, I'm talking about Stanton Friedman, who, when you start talking about Roswell, you cannot help but A, mention his name, but B, stand upon his work. We lost a giant in the industry back in May, didn't we?
Yes, of course we did. And that he certainly served as an international ambassador, not only for the subject, but as you mentioned, Roswell itself, and that it was just very, serendipitous that he happened to be at the right place at the right time and realized that he potentially had a breakthrough case, and that was with Roswell when he first ran into the late Major Jesse Marcel, who was the intelligence officer at Roswell back in 1947, and then the rest is history, obviously.
It sure, yeah. Go ahead.
Yes, Stan was a competitor of ours because we were both investigating the same case. We all agree that that the Roswell case was actually a crash of an extraterrestrial craft, but we differed on a few of the witnesses. But with so many witnesses that we found, that was to be expected. So we were always collegial. Felt him as to be a comrade in arms, promoting the case and defending the case, and so yes, it was a sudden shock because we had no indication that there was anything wrong, and for our latest book, it turned out to be I don't like to use the word fortuitous, but Stan wrote the foreword to our current book that just came out a month or two ago, and we had dedicated the book to him.
Yeah, and that's the one that we're going to be talking about primarily tonight, UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. Gentlemen, let's take a minute for each of you. I kind of want to get an idea of how you both became interested in this topic. Tom, I think you started in high school. You developed an interest in UFOs.
Yes. I was not a big reader, but this was one of the subjects that I did read about. For some reason, it interested me that, my goodness, we're not the only living beings in the universe. I thought, oh my goodness, who are these? What's going on here? And I became interested in the UFOs as a teenager, and read a number of books. I'm thinking back now, the Edward Ruppelt book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, was a terrific book that really piqued my interest. And in 1980, the Roswell Incident book came out, and that sort of really got me going on this one case, because we're talking about a crash, wreckage, bodies, cover-up, threats, the whole, you name it. And it's way more than just lights in the sky. So that's how I got interested in it.
Yeah, it certainly has all the components to make a terrific story, and certainly to warrant a lot of research. Don, how'd you get your interest?
Well, actually, of all places, it started with the Kennedy assassination. And that I was a young boy that particular weekend in November of 63, and my father was away, and so I was the one who just sat up all night watching, just totally captivated as a little boy for what had just taken place.
Yeah.
And then thereafter, with the Warren report, and then the use of the words whitewash and cover up. And it was just a few years later, I was out Christmas shopping, and I came across a book entitled Flying Saucers, Serious Business by Frank Edwards, New York Times bestseller. And on the jacket, on the cover, it used those very same words, whitewash, cover-up. So again, I was captivated. I took the book, and I read it, and there was one particular chapter entitled Who's Driving? And it started to get into the CE3s, the occupant cases, who's driving. And the very next book I bought was The Flying Saucer Occupants. by Coro and Jim Lorenzen, who started the Area Phenomena Research Organization. So it was a whole book on these occupant cases, and I was hooked. High school, I got away with murder in speech class because I was able to lecture on a topic without so much as using a note card, because I was talking about a subject I was becoming more and more an expert on, so to speak. And yet I was still a skeptic on Roswell. I was a total skeptic on the possibility that they could keep something of that magnitude a secret for all that time. But little did we know, and certainly after the first trip to New Mexico in February of 1989, and there's been no turning back ever since.
And we're going to talk about some of those details, but I want to ask you a broader question at this point, because your first eyebrow-raising experience was the Kennedy assassination aftermath. And one of the things that people who are very skeptical about any kind of conspiracy will say is, how can so many people keep such a secret for such a long period of time? Do you think it's possible for a group of conspirators to all remain quiet about something for, you know, half a century?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it. First of all, it hasn't been kept secret all this time. I think that's obviously a misnomer, often perpetrated even within the field itself, because there have been whistleblowers such as Major Marcel and general officers like General Arthur Exxon and General Thomas DeBose and other high-ranking officials who have been, you know, leading the charge as to what's going on for decades now, but nobody's listening. Certainly not the mainstream media. I mean, still treating it like just so much entertainment, and without a piece of physical evidence, you can't prove it, that type of thing. But I think secondly, it's been demonstrated time and time again that, especially with, again, high-ranking officers in the military, they are totally adept at keeping secrets from their families, their spouses. And I think one of the main problems, especially regarding Roswell, is that most of them have taken it with them. I think that's our greatest frustration, that we didn't start sooner on the case, but the fact that we've had so many reluctant officers, specifically the officers with pensions and career, you know, professional careers at stake, that they took it to their graves. And it becomes a self-perpetuating cover-up in that regard. And we're hearing from more and more younger people in the military their frustration that the old order is not passing it down to the new. And I think that's one of the reasons that you see now these young Navy pilots and other personnel that are speaking out, because it's like they've been kept in the dark on the topic all these years. When you really do your homework and do the research into the history of the phenomenon, you realize the evidence has been there all this time.
Tom, do you think that the highest levels of the what I will call the apparent government are aware of these secrets? Like, does the President of the United States have access to this, is this information, or is it in a shadow government somewhere?
Well, the impression that I get is that it's right now it's in a shadow government. Bill Clinton tried to get the information about Roswell, but was denied. Jimmy Carter, same thing. Before he was took office, he said, "I'm going to release." The term was unsettling disclosures about UFOs. But once he got into office, that was it. You never heard from him again about that. And my own view is that it is some sort of shadow group. Well, we won't say in a shadow government, but a shadow group that controls the. Information, the access, and we've only learned recently that all of that stuff now, at least most of it, is in private hands. And I don't mean Uncle Harry down the street. I mean government contractors like Lockheed Martin, Rand Corporation, Mattel, those big corporations that have a lot of projects going, a lot of business with the federal government. But the Air Force has stated their position on it. It was high altitude constant level balloon for the wreckage, and the bodies were just these dime store mannequins that they were testing for high altitude parachute drops of the 1950s. So if you're in the military and you want to get to the next rank, you don't start saying, hey. Hey, General, how about that Roswell case? How about you? That's a career killer. And in the mainstream media, it's still taboo. And you know, it's the subject that, as Don said, that it has been leaking, but a lot of people have taken it to their graves because of their, you know, concern for their employment or their ridicule, something like that.
When we get back from the break, we're going to get into the details of Roswell, so everybody's on the same page here. But in the minute we've got left, when did you two start working together?
Well, that was, I knew Don when he was working with Kevin Randall back around 1991. That's when I got on the case. And after the 1997, when the big anniversary, most everybody left the field, and Don and I knew him from the Center for UFO Studies. We teamed up at that point because we both wanted to continue the investigation in a proactive way rather than just sitting around waiting for something to drop in our laps. That was in May of 1998, if I recall, that we teamed up, and that's what, how many years ago was that? I can't remember. 21 years. Wow.
Yeah, it seems crazy. Gentlemen, let's talk about Roswell a little bit. I don't know which of the two of you would prefer to answer this, maybe both of you, but what's the official version, or what was the official version of events in 1947?
Well, the official version would have been based on that press release that went out on July 8th of 1947, that the Roswell Army Airfield had actually recovered a flying disc. And it was very carefully worded. It didn't give away the location, the witness who reported the crash, so to speak, but it specifically mentioned Major Marcel, who we had mentioned earlier, who was the whistleblower that first broke the story in 1978, of all people, because he would become the patsy, because 5 hours later, Washington then steps in, and you know, one of the main arbiters of the cover-up, General Roger Ramey of the 8th Air Force, which then was the commanding squadron over the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell, the first atomic bomb wing in the world at that time. And it was just replaced with a very off-the-shelf standard Rawin weathered balloon device, you know, comprised of rubber and reflective foil, you know, the kite as far as sticks, string, and masking tape. And that was the story for the next 30 years until Major Marcel and then all those who followed, you know, stepped forward and said, no, it was the very first announcement, which was the correct one, that it was indeed, you know, a flying disc, and it was something not from planet Earth.
When you look at go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say that the since that time, you know, Congressman Stephen Schiff in 1993 instituted an investigation, not to prove Roswell was a spacecraft or not, but to see that the media, the generated telexes and memos and things like that at the time of the crash. That emanating from Roswell and Fort Worth and Washington, to check to see if they were handled and classified correctly, and maybe, you know, see what they said. But it turned out that they had all been destroyed some years earlier by an unknown authority. Now, I don't know if you were in the military or not, but you can't even go to the latrine without authority. And so to have all these records destroyed without authority, it gives one pause to think, well, what's going on here? So at that point, the Air Force instituted some sort of investigation, as they called it, and that's when they come up with this. Oh, it wasn't a weather balloon. It was a series of weather balloons, a high altitude, a constant level number of weather balloons carrying a acoustic microphone to listen in to the expected detonation of an atomic device by the Soviet Union by putting this this acoustic sensor way up in the stratosphere, sphere it was, and listen in that way. And so say, well, that's what crashed. And then 2 years later, in 1997, they said, well, about those bodies that people reported, they were really suffering from a malady called time compression, which only seems to affect pro-Roswell witnesses, that they were recalling these high-altitude parachute drops using dime store mannequins that they were testing in the 1950s, that they came across those out in the desert when they were wandering about, and somehow they mentally, their mind constricted and said, oh, my goodness, that must have been 1947, and that's the Air Force position today. We Don and I think they floated out because that one didn't fly so well. The Air Force officer who held the press conference was actually laughed off the stage when he came out with that dummies from the sky explanation. So we think they floated out that it was a myth, that the Roswell crash is now in the realm of a myth. And they're not going to comment about the case anymore, and that's where we're at.
The event itself, there were many witnesses along this chain of events that ultimately either had to be silent or change their story. What lengths did the Air Force or the military in general go through to keep these people quiet for as long as they were able to?
Well, with the military, it was simply a matter of just providing them or giving them a direct order. And typically, it was nothing in written form. It's not where you would sign a non-disclosure statement upon leaving the service. And for the next 25 years, you'd have to remain silent about any classified information you had access to or were aware of, that type of thing. We have descriptions how they would be taken in the rooms or even in the hangars, and they essentially were threatened. They were warned that they'd be spending the rest of their lives in Leavenworth prison if they ever talked about this again. And there were threats of this physical violence as far as within the ranks of the military. But what obviously is, the myth is disconcerting is the fact that they threaten civilians. We have to always keep in mind that the military has absolutely no authority whatsoever as far as law enforcement unless martial law is declared. And the fact that they took it upon themselves to, threaten and physically accost the sheriff in Roswell at the time, and the firemen who were involved and how their families were threatened, and and parents were told they would kill their children if they ever spoke out on this topic again. And it's a rather unheralded element in all this, and the culpability of the government and for the fact that they did resort to such extreme measures in silencing the witnesses. And is it any wonder that so many of them took it to their grave, that they were just that intimidated, that fearful for speaking out, even regarding the very truth? Because, and one of the other things that we're discovering more and more is that they also threaten civilians with mental asylums, that you'll be put in a mental hospital the rest of your life. And so they resorted to all forms of trickery, but it was thuggish. It was beyond just total intimidation and harassment of civilians. And then when you throw children into the mixture, if these people were still alive, you talk about a class action suit on the part of the witnesses, they'd have a lot of hell to pay.
What was Project Mogul?
Project Mogul was a project instituted by the military, the Army, Army Air Corps, in 1947. Because at the time, the United States was the only nation on the planet with that had the bomb, the atomic bomb. But they expected, we expected the Russians, who had penetrated the Manhattan Project, to at some point develop their own nuclear bomb. So someone discovered, they, you know, we knew that there was a up in the stratosphere, ionosphere, one of those spheres, sound carries very well. So the idea at the time, we're talking now in the 1947, was to put up aloft an acoustic sensor, a microphone, so to speak, carry it aloft and keep it up there in that part of the atmosphere that the sound carries very well. So they developed this device made up of numerous rubber, neoprene rubber balloons, and a number of tinfoil radar targets carrying this acoustic sensor. And the whole device was, 100 feet or more in length, and up it went. And it was done through the with the cooperation of New York University, and they developed this, and ultimately, the Soviet detonation was not discovered by Project Mogul. It was discovered by a chemical composition in the atmosphere. That's how they were able to tell that in 1949, the Soviets detonated their first atomic bomb. But they tried it first with this acoustic sensor. The program was top secret, right? Project Mogul was top secret, but all the parts to it, the balloons, the radar targets, and the acoustic sensors, they were all common off-the-shelf devices that couldn't fool my grandmother. when the balloons burst and came down, they couldn't fool anybody. And none of our witnesses, we have several hundred witnesses, a number of whom were out there cleaning up the wreckage, and not one of them over the years has described the balloon event to us, not one. They all described something that was truly out of this world.
Let's talk about the recovery effort, because one of the important parts of the Roswell story is the part where there were bodies recovered. What do we know about the bodies that were recovered?
Well, to the credit of the witnesses, the fact that they don't call them spacemen, they don't call them ETs or extraterrestrials of anything of that sort. They often refer to the little people or the little men. And as one of the personnel at the base, when we were doing CBS 48 Hours, and he was asked, well, how do you know they weren't from here? To which he responded, well, they sure weren't from Texas. So they fully grasped, you know, what they were dealing with, but the descriptions are totally consistent as to the shape, the size, the little childlike appearance, except for the large disproportionate heads, the larger eyes, diminutive nose, and as far as slit for a mouth and diminutive ears, that type of thing. But the ashen gray skin color and the one piece jumpsuit, the one piece silver-gray garment that covered each one. Again, totally consistent, whether civilian or military. We have two distinct body sites. There was a secondary body site about 2.5 miles from the debris field where the bodies had been lying out there for a number of days, exposed to the elements and predators, that type of thing. But then the final impact site, just about 35 to 40 miles north of Roswell, were a capsule, a pod, egg-shaped, about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And that's where two additional bodies were recovered, more intact, but a survivor. Ooh. Yes, we have eyewitnesses to a survivor to the crash.
Wow. That's new information?
Not really, no. In fact, we had already dealt with that possibility 25 to even 30 years ago, because we were hearing second and third-hand testimony as to a survivor at the main hangar, Building P3, where everything transited through, and even at the base hospital, and eventually that led us to first-hand testimony. And these are witnesses, one in particular who actually, when he first described the survivor and how he had encountered it, became quite emotional. He actually wept as he described the situation. And then his wife chimed in for the fact that they didn't even sleep in the same bedroom for almost 40 years because of his constant, you know, jolting up in the middle of the night and yelling out because he couldn't get the face out of his mind. He just repeated, you know, that experience over and over every day of his life.
But Don, you led and organized, I think, the only three digs at Roswell in the debris field. Is that right? And what'd you find there?
Well, actually, we're up to five.
Oh, okay, nice.
But the first one would have been in September of 1989, and we mapped the site. We laid out a systematic grid. We used the theodolite, a survey meter, to assist us in our accuracy, and we marked areas of potential entrapment. We did some initial shaker box work along an area that the rancher's son, Bill Brazel, described the gouge, a furrow, hundreds of feet long, about 10 foot wide, that type of thing. So it gave us a focal point back at that time. And it was in May of 2002, I was contacted by Larry Landsman, who formerly was with Showtime when we did the Roswell movie in 1994. And he asked me, he was working with the Sci-Fi Channel at that time, and asked you guys if you guys could take this to the next level, what would you like to do? And I immediately said, well, we'd like to do another archaeological dig. And he was unaware of the fact that Tom and I had already approached the contract archaeology department at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And we had been talking to Dick Chapman, who was the head of the department. And we were elated at the fact that they had agreed that with sponsorship, with the funding, that they indeed would, you know, actually conduct such a project. And the 2002 dig then became the subject of the two-hour primetime special on the Sci-Fi Channel, which up to that point was their highest-rated TV production in their 10-year history.
Wow.
So very proud of that. Yeah. We confirmed the gouge with the backhoe operation, where exactly where Brazel and then subsequently other witnesses described its location. And there it was, right below the surface, you know, a symmetrical V, suggesting something had clearly impacted and skipped across the ground at that point. In 2006, we did the next dig with NBC, which was also through Larry Landsman, after NBC had purchased a Sci-Fi and USA Network. And that was more of a reality show at that time, so we were very dissatisfied. It was a waste of the university and our time, as we felt. And then in 2013, we had the Mutual UFO Network, and we had two archaeologists from the Bureau of Land Management, as well as a geologist by the name of Frank Kimler, who assisted us. And then we worked mostly the runoff, the erosion course of the site, and found a few things that shouldn't have been there, but nonetheless, there was nothing that unusual. And then in 2015, we located a final depository site about a mile down from the debris field, where all the runoff, all the erosion finally, you know, comes to rest. And it was about 10 inches of sediment, and we went through all of that over the course of 2 days. Found not so much as a nail or a piece of wire, so now we retrace. So at another point, when we have sufficient funding and sponsorship, we'll make it a sixth try. I would like to add, though, it's interesting that there have been attempts at salting, sabotaging the site. on one occasion a few years ago, someone sprayed nails all over the site as though to contaminate it.
Really?
And we've done ye omen, work in keeping it private, keeping it secret. In fact, as Tom knows, we had a dedication. We have a monument that overlooks the site, so people have some place to go to, take pictures, and it's a fitting tribute as far as to the location. But it's still a half a mile away, because we still consider the actual site an active archaeological site. And as long as we're, continuing our work there, we're going to do all we can to keep it as pristine and untainted as we can.
Tom, they must have done a really, really good job of cleanup back in 1947, in the days after the crash. They didn't leave a stone unturned, did they?
You're reading my mind, JV. The site that we did the archaeological dig was the site that they cleaned up with a fine-tooth comb for many days. And they ran out the teams of 60 or more at a time, 100 or more. They got down on their hands and knees and told to pick up anything that wasn't natural. And so the GIs picked up everything. Now, it's our belief, see, there's three sites that we've identified in the Roswell case. The so-called debris field site, which is what we've been talking about. That's where the ship exploded during a thunder and lightning storm, either from an internal malfunction or from most likely a lightning strike. It exploded and rained down debris in small pieces, and that's the site we did the dig at, several of the digs. It continued on. The inner cabin withstood the blast and traveled another 30, 35 miles and came to rest just north of the town of Roswell. But it's our belief that GIs being GIs, they didn't get it all. We believe there's still stuff out there, especially along that trajectory of about 30 to 35 miles from the debris field site over the body site where the two of them were thrown out and met their ultimate fate, and then the so-called impact site where the inner cabin came to rest. Along that 30 to 35-mile trajectory, we believe it was dropping pieces of wreckage the entire way. But the thing is, we don't have the wherewithal to walk with a large number of people that trajectory along the desert floor to find things that perhaps are now buried over 72 years. So we've concentrated on this one site, but it's the site that, at least I believe, that the military really cleaned up. They vacuumed the site, and I'll be surprised if, luckily so, we find something of a viable piece of wreckage, which is what we're looking for at that site. I believe that there are pieces out there along that trajectory that no one's really looked at because, it's way out in the desert, and most people out there wouldn't know that it's along the trajectory. But that's where I believe a piece will turn up someday there by somebody just fortuitous luck.
I want to get both of your opinions on what seems to be making some headlines, at least some social media stir, is this, I don't even know what we call it. I'll call it an effort, but I think it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek effort to get people to storm Area 51.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's like 2 million people that have signed up on this Facebook page. Obviously, not 2 million people are going to show up, but, some may. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, there's nothing to see out there. There certainly isn't any lodging or any place to really accommodate anyone. So be forewarned if you're just going to even, trek out there just to be a part of the happening, so to speak. But as I even posted on my Facebook page, does anybody remember Tiananmen Square?
Right.
The idea that the military is just going to open the front gate and say, come on in, let's have a picnic about this. If I were to recommend that people, if they really wanted to at least feel that they were getting some truth regarding the UFO phenomena, they should go to the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell. And at least it's a lot safer. There are many, wonderful motels in Roswell and restaurants and things. And not to plug the place, but this is just foolhardy. I mean, the very thought that let's storm, why don't we storm the White House where we're at it and see who gets in the furthest, No, just totally irresponsible. I know the gamer, the party that originally concocted the notion is now backing off and suggesting that it was more of a publicity ploy on his part. But that's the thing when it comes to people that, even though I don't mean to quote him, but I guess it comes down to, the easiest people, and Hitler was the one who used to say this, the easiest people to convince of anything are the people who don't believe anything.
Right.
And so it's just the wrong place to look for answers. And as far as Tom and I are concerned, there really is nothing, if not very little, related to the UFO phenomenon, even at 51.
Tom, let's talk about Wright-Patterson. Make the connection for us between Roswell and Wright-Patterson.
Yes. During World War II, Wright Field, during World War II, it was Wright Field and Patterson Field. They hadn't joined yet to become Wright-Patterson, which actually occurred right after the Roswell incident. But during World War II, German Messerschmitts and the Japanese Mitsubishis were brought to Wright Field for back engineering, to take them apart, nut by bolt, to see what made them tick, so we could perhaps develop things to defeat them in battle. So the back engineering was already taking place at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. So, and also that's where the intelligence function for the Army Air Corps took place, was at the Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. They had this thing called it's gone through several iterations, but we usually refer to it as FTD, the Foreign Technology Division. So when something like a flying saucer crashed at Roswell in 1947, the FTD, the Foreign Technology Division of Wright Field, was already set up to receive this foreign technology. So that's why it went to Wright Field, or later identified as Wright-Patterson, because not only because that was the best place to take it, they also had an advanced aeromedical facility there for the biological remains. But also, the witnesses that we interviewed over the years, they all said that the wreckage and the bodies, it was their understanding, that some of them said it was taken back east, but most of them said it was taken to Wright, or Wright-Patterson. So we have it from the witnesses, but we also have it because functionally, that's the place where it would have gone. And we also have witnesses at Wright-Patterson that were there when it came in. So there's no doubt about it.
Have any of your witnesses indicated that there's more alien material there than just what had been found at Red Roswell? Do they have other craft, other I don't know if we call them artifacts, but other alien artifacts there?
They did. That's where the alien stuff went. The FTD, the Foreign Technology Division.
Right.
But our understanding, JB, is that some point in the early 1980s, because the town of Dayton was building up under, around Wright-Patterson, and that's where all the new aircraft were being developed. And, when you're developing new aircraft, lots of times, or sometimes, not lots of time, but sometimes they crash. And the it was now becoming a cosmopolitan area. So and also the CIA wanted to develop these high altitude spy planes. So Area 51 in Nevada was constructed in 1955 to develop these high altitude super secret spy planes. And our understanding from people on the ground is that the alien artifacts, let's call them, were moved to Area 51 in Nevada in the beginning in the early 1980s. And then in the 1990s, when you had a lawsuit filed by victims of because they were burning hazardous materials there as well, and they got sick and some died, and lawsuits developed, and it was becoming known that that maybe there was some alien stuff there when this fellow Robert Lazar started talking in 1989. So it was becoming known that maybe that's where that stuff was. So since then, it's been moved elsewhere, perhaps to a place in Utah known as Dugway, the old Dugway Proving Grounds, which was a lot like the Nevada test site where the Area 51 was constructed. So some of it went to Dugway, but the bulk of it, which is our understanding, is that it's now in private hands. But that's where the connection came, because it was the place really that that it was already set up for something like something really foreign, like a crash flying saucer.
This is a short segment, guys, but I want to ask about what description some of your witnesses have been able to provide regarding maybe parts of the craft, maybe some of the tech that was there that may or may not have been reverse engineered. How much detail were you able to get?
Well, you will cite the example of the late General Arthur Exon, who was actually there in 1947 as Lieutenant Colonel at Foreign Technology Division, T2 back at that time. And he didn't see the material personally, but because he was assigned to that very building, he was aware of the wreckage coming in from Roswell and was fully aware of all the tests, all the efforts in trying to test the tensile strength, the pressure, the components, even at the molecular level, what they were dealing with. And Exxon would tell us that there was a unanimous consensus afterwards that the materials were from space, that they were not manufactured on planet Earth. And Exxon would even go on years later to be the base commander at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now let's just think of this for a moment. Here he is. He's the highest-ranking officer on the base in 1964, and he would describe to us that there were entire areas of the base that were off limits to him, and he was in charge.
Yeah.
And so that would clearly demonstrate these underground, these subterranean levels, and we've heard as many as 10 levels, and the underground vaults, and even the underground nuclear reactor. I mean, the base is nuclear powered, and to speak to the son of the engineer who designed the one of the vaults that just happens to be under the nuclear reactor on the base. Well, what a strange place for a vault, hiding something. But then you bring all of this into the picture, and you realize that they were doing all they could back at not only in 1947, but thereafter, for all the reported crashes and all the wreckage and all the bodies that supposedly final destination was Wright-Patterson. And then the irony that the Air Force, in their three official UFO investigations, Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book, the most famous of the three, they were all headquartered at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Right.
So it was a one-stop shopping, so to speak. Everything was housed at Wright-Pat, And little did, like Dr. Jalen Hynek, my former scientific director who was consulting to Project Blue Book, little did they know that the evidence was right beneath their noses. It was right there.
Well, this is our last segment, but before we start chatting again, where can people get the book?
The book is carried, of course, with Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. You can Barnes and Noble. I guess they still have bookstores. It would be in there. They're our vendor, and those are the ones that come to mind.
Finer bookstores throughout the country. So
perfect. Let's jump to our listener line here. Let's grab a question from our good friend Barry in South Carolina. Hey Barry, welcome to the program.
Hello, JV. What a pleasure it is to speak to you once again.
And you, sir.
Hall of Fame, JV, in Cooperstown. didn't they take in the Yankees, Ramirez? Was that his name?
No, it's Yankees Mariano Rivera. The best closing pitcher in baseball history is what some of us like to say.
Unbelievable. What a guy. He deserved to be in 3 or 4 Hall of Fame.
I agree.
He is absolutely one of the greatest of all times, and the Yankees, of course, had him. Anyway,
don't get Tom started on the Phillies because
it's a sore subject. Yes.
Listen, I'm curious, and what you guys know about Area 52? I was talking to George Norrie on Coast to Coast the other night. And George Knapp, actually, he lives in Vegas. Anyway, Area 51, of course, gets all the publicity, but I was just curious if you guys knew anything about Area 52. And, JV, thanks for letting me on.
Thank you, Barry. Always a great question. Always great talking to you.
Well, we do mention he's talking about Dugway, believe.
Yeah, Dugway in Utah, yeah.
Yes, we do have something in our book, UFO Secrets at Wright-Patterson, about Dugway. And I think what happened was when they had that lawsuit in the mid-1990s when Clinton was president about the hazmat deal where people were getting sick, the story is that a lot of stuff went to Dugway as Area 52, and others said, oh, no, and people started saying, well, Area 51 is closed down, but none of that took place, and what we do know, Don can, fill in probably a little more than I, but one of the commanders at Wright-Patterson of the Foreign Technology Division, a fellow named George Weinbrenner, I believe he was a general.
No, he was just a full bird, yeah.
Was he a full bird? In charge of the Foreign Technology Division. And on his deathbed, he was quoted as saying that we have five of the aliens in Utah. That would be Dugway. And we believe that the Roswell, we know there were five of them, and the one survivor, of course, expired at some point. So we have five cadavers. Then Colonel Weinbrenner says they're in Dugway. Now, if there's anything else there, I don't know. I don't know.
And then we have a firsthand, another full bird colonel by the name of Robert Mountdragon, who described being shown one of the bodies in the late 50s at Dugway. And then when I posed the question, and he just passed away within the last month, Colonel Robert Friend, who was the second last director of Project Blue Book, and I asked him, if you had biological remains, if you had bodies from a crashed UFO, where would they be today? And he immediately responded, oh, well, of course, Dugway, the Biological Medical Research Facility. And so that was just additional confirmation that we indeed may be on the right track. Area 52, absolutely correct.
All right, we're going to run out of time before we run out of questions here. Who was Leonard Stringfield?
Leonard Stringfield was a Cincinnati, Ohio businessman who had an interest in UFOs. He wrote a book called Situation Red, The UFO Siege, something like that, and he would give talks. And he developed a lot of contacts in Dayton and at Wright-Patterson, who started feeding him stories of crashed UFOs. Now, up until Leonard Stringfield, the subject of crashed UFOs was a taboo subject. The Donald Kehoe, the great promoter for UFOs are real in the late 1940s and during the 1950s, he wouldn't go near crashed UFO stories because he thought they were a bridge too far for him. He thought that such stories would taint the whole UFO phenomenon that he was trying to get the credibility for. So he stayed away from them. But Leonard Stringfield started accumulating these stories from people who were at Wright-Patterson and who lived in Dayton who heard these stories. And he started accumulating these stories about crashed UFOs. He finally published a monograph in 1978 called... Recoveries of the Third Kind. I could have that wrong, but it was about crashed UFOs. So he started the whole business of that possibly, crashed UFOs have taken place. And so we call him the father of crashed UFOs. And he passed away,
95.
Part of the difficulty here is that we have lost so many, if not nearly all, of the witnesses to many of these events. It becomes more and more difficult to get any of this information.
Exactly, as we've often, just lamented the fact that we're racing with the Undertaker, and the Undertaker is about to win. And now we're losing also the families, the children of Roswell. And we realize that now we have to, conduct more and more of the physical, the archaeological work, more and more of the archival, the documents. And one of the things we're also looking forward to is, and we talked about Stan Friedman at the beginning of the program, that now having an opportunity to go through all of his files. And I'm sure there are many leads, many names of possible eyewitnesses that he did not follow up on. I'm sure it'll be too late, but it doesn't mean we can't track down the families.
Right.
And acquire. What's great about the secondhand testimony, when it corroborates the firsthand, it then solidifies the firsthand even more. And so, we've worked with lawyers for too many years who continue to encourage us that as long as there are eyewitnesses, even second and third hand, that it builds the case. And the point being overall is that we're not finding a single witness to anything conventional, anything prosaic.
When we talk about the government working so hard to keep this a secret for so many years, is it your opinion that the government is doing that because they don't want our military enemies to understand or know what has happened? Or is it because they need to keep it secret from us, from the public? Which of the two, or is it both?
It's both. Back in 1947, they had fairly credible reasons to keep it secret, because the Cold War was just starting up in 1947, and the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And, the Soviets had, it penetrated the development of the atomic bomb, the Manhattan Project, and we didn't want them to perhaps get the technological advantage if they penetrated the recovery of this crashed saucer, because we didn't know what we had. Certainly a ship from another planet somewhere in the universe, it would have a technology that we might want to exploit, and we didn't want the Russians to actually get wind of this, what it really was, and perhaps exploit some of the stuff. They were good at it themselves, And so that was one reason. The other main reason was in 1938, the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast featuring Orson Welles put the East Coast, parts of the East Coast of the United States, in a panic. They presented the show. It was based on H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds story, but they portrayed it as a news, we interrupt this broadcast type thing, and the East Coast went into a panic. So the higher-ups in the Air Corps at the time, and most notably General Hoyt S. Vandenberg, who was controlling the whole situation from Washington, he did not want panic in the streets. That's what he was most afraid of. So he put the kibosh on the Roswell story that had broken the newspaper. He killed it in the media, and for the next 30 years, they killed it. So back then, they had fairly credible reasons for. Also, they wanted to find out what they had, and you don't announce to the world, folks, we don't know what this is. So until they found out more about it, they had good reason, perhaps, to kill the story. So why is it still covered up? Well, what happens is you get something like this, and it gets a momentum of its own.
Yeah.
People come and go, but the momentum is still there. It's been always covered up, so let's keep it covered up. And also, there's a risk. There's a risk to divulging. If they divulge tomorrow, folks, we've Roswell was real, UFOs were real. We've been lying to you for 72 years. Well, how's that going to go over?
Right.
You know, what else are you lying about us? So they keep it covered up because we also believe that they still don't know what they still haven't figured it out.
It becomes self-perpetuating. Let's grab another phone call here. This is Fred from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Fred, welcome back to the program. Always great to have you on.
Yeah, hey, JV. Very interesting. Yeah, the other lie is that your children's Social Security is going to work.
Exactly.
What I wanted to ask was, I saw a guy on TV or some 2-5 years ago, whatever, that was getting very old. He said he worked, I think, at Wright-Patterson, and that he wanted people to know his inventions weren't really his, that he would go in a room with pencil and paper, and they would have an alien come in or two, and without even any, you know, just telepathy, he would start writing this stuff down, he said. And so there must have been, if that's true, more than one alien that lived and continued to live from some that they picked up somewhere else. So I was going to see if y'all knew anything on that or who this was.
That one escaped us. And we've heard just about every such story regarding, you know, the recovery of survivors from a UFO crash, or certainly the attempted reverse engineering of the technology. But we know, though, as far as with in the event of a survivor, I mean, we've heard, for example, that there were linguists that were brought in an attempt to communicate. We know that as far as with the autopsies, that they brought in doctors from all different specialties. We long cite the example of Dr. Lejeune Foster, who was president of the American Chiropractic Association back in 1947. And her very housekeeper talked about how she was flown in the right path and returned a week later, scared to death because she was threatened that if she ever said a word about what she had experienced, and her assignment was to do nothing more than examine the spinal cords, you know, that type of thing. So there was nothing in the Army Field Manual dealing with this phenomenon back in 1947, that they were making this up as they went along.
Well, I think this was even later, you know, later than then, a lot later.
So this wasn't directly related?
Even at that point, because, and Tom is absolutely correct, we still maintain that it's a cover-up of ignorance, that they still have no answers. They still don't know from where, from why, or from who. And they've tried and attempted every device possible in getting a breakthrough, trying to go to the next level. And I think it's also a point of arrogance on our part that we would think that we could bridge the technology, that if you're dealing with something that is 100, 200, 500, 1,000 years ahead of us, that we could just automatically, you know, bridge that gap, so to speak.
Fred, thank you for that great question and that great point. We're just out of time, guys. The book is called UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson, Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. And you mentioned where people can get it. Mention it again and also let people know where they can follow your work.
Well, you could get the book on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or your friendly bookstore, most notably Barnes & Noble. And I don't know, Don, can we get it on our website? Do we have a
No, we shifted that over to the museum, the International UFO Museum and Research Center, their gift shop, their online store.
Yes, and our website is www.roswellinvestigator.com, and the International UFO Museum in Roswell has it. And I think that's pretty much it.
Guys, thank you so much for spending the time with us tonight, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you, JV. Great that you gave us this opportunity to discuss what we believe is the biggest story of the millennium. Thank you, JV.
The Roswell incident never leaves the headlines of the UFO community, ever. It's considered to be the holy grail of experiences when it comes to the to UFO investigation and reports, and the fact that there's still pretty good evidence of a cover-up of some kind, one form or another, makes it a very, very interesting story.
Sure. I mean, it was the closest we ever came to an actual official statement by anybody in any position of authority.
Yeah, hand me that book over there, the one we got yesterday. No, the one we got yesterday, because I don't know if you remember, folks, a couple, last week we had Captain T.C. Randall on. We were talking about his book, Forbidden Healing, which we didn't have a copy of at the time, but we got it. I mean, this thing had to be like delivered by special delivery because this is a massive book.
It is, and it's well done, and it's full of information and charts. Great book.
And he also said that he was really impressed by our audience's response, and a lot of people were interested in this. So I'm anxious to read this myself. It looks pretty cool, so I can't throw it. It's going to hurt something. Anyway, that's going to do it for tonight. We'll be back on with you tomorrow night. Thanks for being here, and we'll see you tomorrow. It's Beyond Reality Radio.
Beyond Reality Radio is hosted by Jason Hawes and J.V. Johnson and produced by Alexandria Johnson and Slick Eddie Edwards for Entercom Radio. Beyond Reality Radio is distributed by Westwood One Radio Networks. Stop by our Facebook page and say hello. Follow the hosts on Facebook as well. For Jason Hawes, follow at jasonhawes.taps. For J.V. Johnson, follow at jvjparanormal. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Radio or you have a suggestion for a guest, contact Slick Eddie Edwards at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com. Be sure to visit our chat room as well at beyondrealityradio.com. Thanks for listening.